Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
They did it out in the open, and they were proud of it. They tweeted this video as they did it. And then they applauded themselves when they were done. 11 Arizona Republicans met on December 14th, 2020, at Republican Party headquarters in Phoenix and signed documents representing themselves as the duly elected and qualified electors for president and vice president of the United States of America from the state of Arizona. And then they transmitted those documents to the National Archives and to Congress for counting by Vice President Mike Pence on January 6th. Even though Joe Biden had won Arizona by more than 10,000 votes. And you know the rest. Now, tonight, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays has indicted those 11 fake electors on felony criminal charges, along with seven other co-conspirators affiliated with Trump's 2020 presidential campaign. Those co-conspirators are names that will be familiar to you. According to reporting from multiple outlets, they are Mark Meadows, Trump's former White House chief of staff, Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, John Eastman, and Christina Bobb, all of whom were lawyers advising or representing Donald Trump in various post-election lawsuits and schemes, along with Trump campaign officials Boris Epstein and Mike Roman. Five of these seven people were also indicted for similar conduct in the state of Georgia, where Jenna Ellis has already pleaded guilty. Now, the 11 Arizona fake electors were part of a multi-state scheme to help President Trump overturn the results of the 2020 election. And there are already prosecutions of at least some of these fake electors in three of the seven states involved in that multi-state scheme, including Georgia, Michigan, and Nevada. But tonight marks the first time that criminal charges are being brought in the state of Arizona.
We're here because justice demands an answer to the efforts that the defendants and other unindicted co-conspirators allegedly took to undermine the will of Arizona's voters during the 2020 presidential election. Arizona's election was free and fair. The people of Arizona elected President Biden. Unwilling to accept this fact, the defendants charged by the state grand jury allegedly schemed to prevent the lawful transfer of the presidency. A state grand jury made up of everyday regular Arizonans has now handed down felony indictments for all 11 Republican electors, as well as several others connected to this scheme. These charges include fraud, forgery, and conspiracy. These charges are class 2, 4, and 5 felonies. These are serious indictments.
As for Donald Trump himself, he is not charged in this indictment, but he does appear as unindicted co-conspirator number one. Joining me now are NBC News correspondent Vaughn Hilliard and Lisa Rubin, MSNBC legal correspondent. Lisa, first, my first thought when I read this was, okay, who's going to plead out? Just because we saw a sort of similar scenario, minus Trump, or plus Trump in Georgia, and we've seen plea deals there. And I just wonder, this is a fairly relatively wide net, 18 people in this. Yeah. Is your expectation that some of them are going to plead out and become witnesses for the state?
Yes, although some of the usual suspects are already unindicted co-conspirators here because they chose in advance of the indictment to cooperate. Namely, Ken Chesbro appears to be unindicted co-conspirator 4 in this indictment. There is also no role here for Sidney Powell, who is the other person to have pled out in Georgia. On the other hand, you have all 11 Arizona alternate or fake electors indicted here. Ooh. Chances are that more than one of them will eventually plead out and give their cooperation.
It is notable that, Vaughn, that that Kenneth Chesbrough seems to be, and this is according to some reporting in the Washington Post, that he seems to have been an important source in all of this. And I'll read an excerpt from the Post reporting tonight. Chris Mays, the attorney general, had been squarely focused on local conservatives up until late last year. Then Arizona prosecutors and investigators met in December with Kenneth Chesbrough. Chesbrough provided Mays' team with records, some previously unseen, that revealed more information about those involved in the Arizona effort. After that, they said, the Arizona investigation widened. How did she go about this, Vaughn? Because it sounds like she started kind of near the top, which is the inverse of how, I don't know, the DOJ has approached the January 6th related controversies.
The Arizona targets were the easiest of targets because, as you said, Alex, they did it out in the open. They were openly tweeting about it. They were openly posting the video of what they did on December 14th when they signed the certificate, the fake certificate, and sent it to Washington, D.C. These other seven individuals, the likes of John Eastman to Rudy Giuliani to Christina Bob, that are still redacted in this indictment because they have yet to be actually served here. These were individuals that were tougher targets here in part of a greater a conspiracy that is outlined by Chris Mays. This investigation we first reported on this last summer, and clearly she had, I guess what you could call it, easier targets. She could have just focused on the 11 electors, but Chris Mays, who came into office in January of last year, clearly intended to target and make it clear that this conspiracy was not only a threat to the 2020 election, but also the 2022 election and potentially future elections. And clearly made the decision to proceed in cast a wider net. And if I may, what is notable about her indictment here is the fact that she specifically outlines the fact that she contends that the 11 electors, and as well as these other seven who are indicted as well, that were Trump attorneys or Trump campaign officials, that they intended to deceive the Arizona voters. I just want to read part of this. Defendants deceived the citizens of Arizona by falsely claiming that those votes were contingent only on a legal challenge that would change the outcome of the election. In reality, defendants intended that their false votes for Trump-Pence would encourage Pence to reject the Biden-Harris votes on January 6, 2021, regardless of the outcome of the legal challenge. I was there on the ground in Arizona as all of this was unfolding, Alex. And I can tell you, I remember so distinctly that they were just making the case that, well, this is just an if in the scenario we actually found fraud, that Mike Pence could then go this route. But what Chris Mays is outlining in this indictment is that this was a conspiracy intended for on January 6th or in those 2 weeks to follow to seat Donald Trump as president, whether he actually had 270 electoral college votes or not.
Yeah. And we actually I was struck by the same passage in the indictment, Vaughn. Can we bring it back up again? Lisa, this seems legally very, very significant that the sort of cover under which some of these fake electors have operated, not just in Arizona, but in other states. Well, this was a contingency plan. She completely disassembles that in the indictment.
I thought that that passage about the email sent from unindicted co-conspirator 5 to a Pennsylvania attorney is really damning because it says, also, just FYI, I recall now there was a rush to file our petition in order to give legal cover for the electors in Arizona to vote on the 14th. That email is stunning. And that has been in the public domain before. In fact, you can identify from other public reporting who the unindicted co-conspirator is. But I had forgotten about these details. It's just like many of the details and the hush money trial that's currently going on are things that we have known for years. So too is this an email that's been out in the public domain. But juxtaposed against all of the litigation that was filed in Arizona to see it one after the other fail. And then this admission from the unindicted co-conspirator, oh, by the way, this was the cover. We were supposed to file this other lawsuit in order to give legal cover to the fake elector scheme.
We're giving you a reason.
Correct.
And it's all there. I you know, Vaughn, when we talk about the ways in which this is an effort on the part of the AG, not just to seek accountability for what happened in 2020, but to, I think, ensure against future fraudulent election behavior. You pointed this out in a conversation with my colleague Chris Hayes last hour that, you know, some of these people who have been indicted are still very much involved with the Arizona election infrastructure. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Right. And let's just use Tyler Boyer as an example. Tyler Boyer is not going to be a household name to most folks, but he is the RNC committee man from Arizona. So he is the one that at every RNC meeting, winter meeting, summer meeting, he's the one that has a vote for Arizona, picks the chair of the party, for example. He is the person who is not only one of these fake electors indicted, but also RNC committee man, but he's also the chief operating officer of Turning Point USA, which is the Charlie Kirk organization, the Trump-aligned organization that has garnered millions of dollars and has effectively taken over the Arizona Republican Party in recent years. Tyler Boyer, Charlie Kirk, they're close with the likes of Kerry Lake, Abe Hamadeh, who was the opponent to Chris Mays in the attorney general's race in 2022 and was an election denier. And there has been a lot of frustration in the Republican Party from some folks who have been around the Republican Party for a while with individuals like Tyler Boyer, and it's Kelly Ward as well, who came in and sort of had this revolution, right? They ousted the likes of John McCain. They ousted Jeff Flake. Kelly Ward ran against Jeff Flake for the U.S. Senate in a Republican primary. And Jeff Flake dropped out because he was losing in polling to Kelly Ward. And so all of these years later, these folks effectively took over the party, are still effectively running the party. Their allies are the ones running for office here. And there is little in Kerry Lake's Senate run here in 2024 is evidence of this. It's the same allies of these very individuals that we're naming in this indictment here, along with folks like Boris Epstein, who is also an indicted in this, who is continues to be the lead counsel advisor, legal advisor for Donald Trump's 2024 campaign. All of these folks are still very much in the game. So it's not just a matter of 2020 as a bygone era, making good on trying to bring justice to past actions. But these are folks that are still intimately involved with what is happening over the next 6 months of the ahead of the 2024 election, Alex.
Just to that end, Lisa, what do you foresee as the sort of handshake between the Georgia case and the Arizona case, given the overlapping defendants in both? I mean, the fact that Jenna Ellis has pleaded out in Georgia, does that suggest to you that she's going to plead out here? I mean, what can we map from Georgia onto Arizona?
It's difficult to say because the facts are different and some of the communications also are very different. One thing that strikes me, though, is who isn't here. Uh-huh. And that's obviously the former president of the United States,
yeah,
who's not a defendant here. And that leaves many people scratching their heads as to why not. I'll venture one guess. On Thursday, that's tomorrow, the United States Supreme Court is going to hear Trump's presidential immunity argument. He has made presidential immunity arguments not only in the federal election interference case, but also in the Georgia case, also in the Florida case. One reason that Chris Mays may not have indicted Donald Trump here is because she wants to see how that plays itself out first and also give some of those indicted a chance to flip against the bus.
Just when you think the screw has turned all the ways it can, there is another turn of the screw. Vaughn Hilliard, amazing reporting. Deep Arizona knowledge, deep cuts from the Arizona election interference. Really appreciate your time tonight, sir.
Thanks, Alex.
Lisa Rubin, stay with me. We got a lot more for you coming up. Trump has a new nickname tonight, unindicted co-conspirator number one. But tomorrow he will be back in a Manhattan courtroom and known as Defendant Trump in his criminal hush money trial. We'll have more on the former president's escalating legal dramas coming up next.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
We are awaiting a ruling from the judge in Donald Trump's New York City hush money case, Judge Juan Merchan, on the issue of Trump's gag order. Prosecutors are asking for 10 $1,000 fines, $1,000 for each alleged violation of the gag order. But as they put it in court yesterday, that is all they are asking for as of now. Prosecutors have made clear that while they are not yet seeking an incarceratory penalty, meaning jail time for President Trump, they believe that Trump seems to be angling for just that. And for what it's worth, right-wing media seems to be angling for that, too.
I would force them to throw me in jail if I were Donald Trump. The mugshot backfired. The indictments have been backfired. Being a martyr in jail for maybe, what, a day, 24 hours? I think that would be just good.
If they put him in jail for his First Amendment right, he will be like Nelson Mandela.
Will he be like Nelson Mandela? Anyway, right after the hearing on Trump's gag order yesterday, right after Trump was warned again that if he kept breaking the rules of the gag order, he could be thrown in jail, pretty much as soon as the court went to break and he was allowed to use his phone again, Donald Trump posted this to Truth Social. Highly conflicted, to put it mildly, Judge Juan Merchan has taken away my constitutional right to free speech. Everybody is allowed to talk and lie about me, but I am not allowed to defend myself. This is a kangaroo court, and the judge should recuse himself. While attacking the judge does not run afoul of the gag order, Trump is clearly poking the bear here, running right up to the line of what's allowed. And there is, yes, the legal side of this gag order, and we're going to get some expert help unpacking that in just a minute, but there is also the media component here. Yesterday in court, we learned the full story of how the National Enquirer and Donald Trump were in cahoots, not just when it came to catching and killing stories about Trump, like the Stormy Daniels story that's at the center of this case, but also the explicit agreement between Trump and the National Enquirer. The National Enquirer would publish glowing stories about Trump and negative stories about his political opponents, ones the Enquirer would embellish or just completely fabricate. So Trump and the National Enquirer had an explicit symbiotic relationship. Having access to Donald Trump helped the National Enquirer, giving its readers what they apparently wanted. So the Enquirer helped Trump, however he wanted. And just to be clear here, it was a totally unethical arrangement, but it really seems like Trump and the right wing and right wing media today are doing something quite similar. There may not be an explicit agreement, but there is certainly a symbiotic relationship here. And that could really matter when it comes to this gag order. From the very beginning of this trial, right-wing media has been repeating Trump's lies about this case, even the small stuff, like claiming that the judge barred Trump from going to his son's high school graduation. In reality, the judge has yet to make a decision on that request. In ways both big and small, right-wing media has been diminishing Trump's potentially illegal actions in this case and claiming that Trump being prosecuted is the real injustice here.
Do you think this is just compensation for a non-disclosure agreement, which happens all the time in big businesses especially?
It was not wrong. You hire lawyers to solve problems, lawyers solve those problems, you pay them. That's it.
You back up 2,000 years, and this is the kind of thing that they would do in the Roman Republic that led to the end of the Roman Republic.
I beg to differ on that last point. Trump has himself, twice now, had his aides print out a big stack of articles for him. Articles he then waves around outside the courthouse, claiming that the content of these articles vindicates him.
These are articles that were over the last day and a half. They're very good articles. They say the case is a sham and it shouldn't even be tried. It shouldn't have been submitted. Jonathan Turley, Greg Jarrett, Andrew McCarthy, every one of them saying they called a zombie case.
The people Trump listed off there, Jonathan Turley, Greg Jarrett, Andrew McCarthy, the authors of these articles that Trump says vindicate him, all of those people are Fox News regulars, contributors, analysts, very likely paid by Fox. And all of them are saying things that are wildly off from what the rest of the legal world has concluded about this case. As much as Donald Trump is kicking and screaming about how he needs to be able to attack the witnesses and the prosecutors and the jury, as much as Trump is claiming that the judge must kill this gag order so that Trump can mount a proper public defense, does Donald Trump really need to do it himself? because he sure seems to have plenty of other people doing that for him already. Last week, right-wing media, and in particular Fox News host Jesse Waters, demonized individual members of this jury. And one of the things prosecutors cited specifically as one of the instances of Trump breaking his gag order was Trump quoting Jesse Waters and saying, "They are catching undercover liberal activists lying to the judge in order to get on the Trump jury." But here's the thing. Jesse Waters didn't actually say that. Trump added the part that read, "in order to get on the Trump jury." But within hours, Jesse Waters corrected Trump's mistake for him, posting Trump's incorrect version of the quote to Waters' own Twitter account, in effect, retroactively making his own words the words that Trump wanted them to be. Quite clearly and quite literally, they are heeding Trump's calls. They are taking his line edits. So what does a gag order mean when you have someone like this with a microphone?
The guy needs exercise. He's usually golfing. And so you're going to put a man who's almost 80 sitting in a room like this on his butt for all that time. It's not healthy. He needs sunlight and he needs activity. They're freezing him to death. They're putting him in a meat locker. He says it's like 45 degrees in there. And they're putting his life in danger.
Back with me again is Lisa Rubin, MSNBC legal correspondent, and Brian Stelter, Vanity Fair's special correspondent and author of Network of Lies, the epic saga of Fox News, Donald Trump, and the battle for American democracy. Thank you both for being here tonight. I don't know, Brian. What's the point of a gag order, honestly, when you have a media industrial complex that is effectively acting as, a public defense line for Donald Trump?
I think you're asking exactly the right question. This was on my mind last week with the debates about the jurors and how much should media outlets be sharing about the jury. No matter how much was shared by NBC or the New York Times or the AP, you're always going to have Fox and these other outlets that are going to try to intimidate the jurors. And now, a week later, the same story is true when it comes to these witnesses. I think it's so important you're identifying this because we have to be able to see, while we are on Earth 1, what is happening on Earth 2? A year ago today, Tucker Carlson was fired by Fox News. And to Fox's credit, Fox is a little bit less in Crazyville as a result. Tucker believes in UFOs and connections to God. For Jesse Waters, Trump is God, right? And that is the programming every hour of every day on these other networks.
Can I ask you, because you've been inside the Fox complex or you've reported, you have deep connections and have reported out from there, the arrangement between Trump and the National Enquirer was explicitly symbiotic, right? Literally saying, we want a story about Ted Cruz, go publish, go write one. And the National Enquirer would fabricate one, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that Trump even, does he have the access to even be able to have an arrangement like that at Fox News? He communicates directly with Sean Hannity.
Yes, he does with individual hosts. Not with the network as a whole. Lachlan Murdoch, who runs Fox, is in Australia a lot of the year. He's not wired in the way that his father Rupert was or the way that, other moguls like David Pecker were. Lachlan doesn't want to be, but Lachlan wants to keep the business humming. And this is all about business. That's what exactly is the same with David Pecker and the Enquirer. This is entirely about a financial relationship. They believe they have a fiduciary.
Fiduciary.
They believe this is the responsibility they have to the shareholders to keep the pro-Trump propaganda going, to keep the viewers watching. And then what you'll see on the air on Fox, when they interview voters, the voters are saying the exact same things that Jesse Waters is saying.
Right. Well, it's a feedback loop.
100%.
From a legal perspective, this seems like terra incognito to some degree, right, Lisa? I was struck by last week when the jurors, literally multiple jurors, were saying, I'm worried about my safety. And Judge Mershon said, I am directing that the press simply apply common sense and refrain from writing about anything that has to do, for example, with physical descriptions of the jurors. That's just not necessary. It serves no purpose. He's asking the press, and that included the mainstream press, fairly.
Yes.
But is his ability to circumscribe the amount of information put out there as it concerns the press reduced to just requests? Or is there anything legally he can do to guard against this?
I think many of us in the press who are in that room took those requests more as a directive. As he continued in that court transcript, it became clear that it wasn't really much of a request at all. And there were some people in the room who were really bristling at what they perceived was an incursion on their First Amendment rights. That having been said, I want to go back to something that you and Brian were discussing about the feedback loop, because I do think that there is a point to the gag order in that you're cutting off some of that feedback loop.
I noticed
the Trump of it all.
The Trump of it all, which is to say, you know, one of the things that struck me is Trump took something that he liked that Jesse Waters said at 5 o'clock. He added to it and made it more insidious. And then 3 hours later, that entire thing comes back out of Jesse Waters' mouth. To the extent that the gag order succeeds in interrupting some of that feedback loop where Trump gets amplified by conservative media, but also is taking from conservative media and that stack of articles,
the things
that he likes.
Yeah.
That might be a good thing, particularly when the DA's office is arguing republication is a violation of the gag order in and of itself, which is something that Todd Blanche argued to the contrary. He said, you know, the gag order prohibits making statements or directing others to make statements. It doesn't prohibit publication. The DA's office almost laughed at that and said, Your Honor, this isn't a totally fair analogy, but defamation law prohibits republication. If you can be held liable for republishing somebody else's lies, why is it okay for him to do it in the context of this gag order?
But don't sleep on this. When he's sharing these lies from Fox, he's misinforming himself as well as his fans.
Yeah.
He's actually getting a warped sense of this trial, of the surroundings, of why his fans aren't showing up to the courthouse, which cracks me up that he thinks that thousands are being denied entry when no one really wants to come. He's being misinformed.
Yes.
Which, by the way, really hurt his presidency, and it's hurt his post-presidency as well. All of us in our lives, we need someone tell us the truth.
Yes.
To tell us when we got ketchup on our tie or when there's hair dye dripping down our face. It doesn't seem Trump has that person. Instead, he has the opposite. He has these people that lie to him on television every day and every night. And I would argue that probably hurts him over time during this trial.
Do you think removing him from part of the feedback loop changes the sort of mendacity over at Fox? I mean, Jesse Waters came up with these juror-like conspiracies independent of Donald Trump. Remember that Donald Trump theoretically just retweeted, you know, an edited version of what Jesse Waters came up with. Right. And I just wonder, does the toxicity level decrease at all if the gag order is more punitive?
If it's enforced, which
is
the other
thing. Question.
And, you know, I want to point out, Alex, something to you, because the dynamic between Mershon and Trump now is very much a parallel to the dynamic between Trump and Judge Lou Kaplan, who oversaw both E. Jean Carroll trials. There was a moment, and excuse me, because I'm reading from an NBC News article.
You're allowed to use your phone.
Where at the last trial, he said, Mr. Trump, I hope I don't have to consider excluding you from the trial. I understand you are very eager for me to do that. And as Trump was walking out of the courtroom, I remember him like sort of pounding the table and go, I would love that. I would love that.
Well,
and that's sort of the dynamic that's going on with Mershon, and Mershon knows that too. And so the trick for him is to hold out the stick without actually hitting Trump with it.
Well,
but be credible.
And that is something, I mean, we started this segment talking about the ways in which Trump is running right up to the line. Right-wing media is saying, go get arrested, sit in the cell for 6 hours. It's not only going to be great for your brand, it's going to be great for fundraising. We have details. Right. I think Trump raised $5.6 million in the first week of the hush money trial, an average of $1 million a day. He knows where his bread is buttered on this.
It's so perverse that all of a sudden these law and order Republicans care deeply about the humanity of the criminal justice system. Right. Jesse Waters is comparing Trump's treatment to Guantanamo Bay prisoners. I fantasize, and that's not going to happen, that we're going to see some movement as a result to actually improve the prisons and the courthouses and all of the rest. I know it's not going to happen, but it's incredible to see how they're waking up all of a sudden to what it's actually like to be a criminal defendant.
Right. Well, it's as it concerns one particular person who might face jail time.
Their God. That's what this is about. They are worshiping their cult leader.
Why haven't we gotten a ruling from Judge Mershon on this gag order yet?
Well, Judge Mershon is a very, very careful jurist. He said yesterday at the end of the hearing that he wanted the parties to give him any additional authority that they wanted to bring to his attention. Mm-hmm. You'll recall that he invited Todd Blanche to cite case law to him that said essentially that republication was not a violation of the gag order. He did not. So both parties had an invitation to give him more between Tuesday night and today. I suspect we'll see something from Judge Mershon tomorrow or Friday in writing that he'll read from the bench and then make available for the public to see. In the meantime, the DA's office has told us they're going to file a third order to show cause with respect to some additional statements. And then just yesterday, while we were at the trial, Donald Trump, I guess before the trial, must have done an interview with a news outlet in which he said some of the same things about Michael Cohen that have gotten him in this pickle in the first place. So, you know, the escalation is happening
even before the verdict or the ruling comes out on these existing violations.
Yes, poking the bear quite literally. Well, hopefully the guardrails will narrow tomorrow when the trial begins again with Dave Pecker on the stand. Lisa Rubin, Brian Stelter, no two better people to talk about this with. Thank you both for your time and wisdom this evening. Still ahead tonight, I will talk to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar about the massive protests against the war in Gaza, heating up on college campuses across the country. But first, tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. sharp, the Supreme Court will finally hear arguments on the question Donald Trump hopes is his get-out-of-jail-free card. Is he immune from prosecution for everything he did while he was president? That's next.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in Donald J. Trump versus the United States. That is the case that will decide whether Trump can claim presidential immunity for his actions in and around the 2020 election and election subversion, and therefore have his federal election interference case dismissed. Now, this case has effectively been frozen since December, as the appeals process here has dragged on, to the chagrin of anyone hoping the high court might expedite its ruling. 7 weeks ago, the Supreme Court decided to add this case to the end of its current term, which could mean that its decision may not come down until as late as July. The mere fact that the Supreme Court chose to take up this case in the first place basically guaranteed some kind of delay. And that, in the end, may be the most significant result of this appeal. Here's Rolling Stone describing Team Trump's attitude on the eve of oral arguments. Team Trump is ready to lose the Supreme Court immunity case. They're celebrating. Donald Trump's inner circle doesn't expect the Supreme Court to go along with his extreme arguments about executive power in the immunity case before the justices. But we already pulled off the heist, says a source close to Trump. Joining us now is Mark Joseph Stern, senior writer covering the courts and the law for Slate Magazine. Mark, thank you for being here tonight. First off, what are your expectations for these oral arguments tomorrow? And do you have any sort of, game strategy as far as what the conservative and liberal justices on the court might do in terms of question and answer?
So, look, I don't think that the liberal justices are going to go as hard as some of us might like to see at Trump's attorneys. I think their number one goal will be to get John Roberts, Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett on board with a decision that is quick and firm and can be sent back down to the lower courts to kick this trial back into motion. Now, with those three conservatives, they are clearly the ones to watch. I think that Thomas and Alito have staked out a pretty strong pro-Trump position. Gorsuch is somewhere in between. But, you know, I think that for Chief Justice Roberts especially, he probably recognizes at this point what that Rolling Stone article pointed out, which is that Team Trump has pulled off the heist. You know, the Supreme Court has slow-walked this case as compared to the ballots removal case from earlier this term, the Nixon cases in the 1970s during Watergate. They have ensured, I think, that this trial will not happen before November, before Election Day. And, you know, when John Roberts is embarrassed by a case, sometimes he kind of goes quiet. He doesn't say anything. And so one thing I'll be looking to is whether the Chief Justice mostly keeps his mouth shut or whether he tries to direct arguments towards some kind of consensus position.
I know that the Supreme Court is, quote unquote, impenetrable and they don't pay attention to press and they're not, you know, they're not victim to whatever the political climate of the day is. But do you think the widespread public outcry over the slow pace with which they've taken this up, the fact that they took it up at all to begin with, will inform the timeline upon which they rule? Like, do you think they're going to expedite their ruling at all, if not the actual hearing?
I do not. And I'll tell you why. Because the rule at the Supreme Court is that as long as a dissenter is still writing his or her opinion, the court will not release the ruling. That was put to the test after the draft decision in Dobbs leaked, that decision overturning Roe v. Wade. We know that some of the conservative justices pressed to release that decision quickly while the dissenters were still writing, but a majority decided to honor that tradition and not release it until the end of the term. I think that tradition will hold here as well. And what that means is that it effectively gives Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas an opportunity to help run out the clock for Trump. You know, they might take longer than they really need to in writing their dissents, drag this out until the end of June, perhaps the beginning of July, and in effect, push this trial date back even further. There's really nothing that the other justices can do about that. So I do not think we should expect a quick turn ruling in this case.
Wow. Can we just talk about Clarence Thomas for a moment? Because his wife was very much a booster of the big lie. He has declined to recuse himself from this. As of late, Thomas has been speaking more from the bench than he usually does. On something like this, where he's so clearly, well, he apparently has maybe a conflict of interest or shouldn't maybe be ruling on it at all, would you expect that he will be vocal tomorrow?
Oh, absolutely. Clarence Thomas's superpower, I think, is shamelessness. And we saw this last week with the big January 6th case about obstruction charges filed against 350 of the January 6th rioters, as well as Donald Trump. Clarence Thomas was leading the charge, arguing that these obstruction charges brought against the rioters was illegitimate. He was accusing the Justice Department of essentially engaging in selective prosecution, of whipping out this arcane statute just to use against political enemies. I mean, he was out front and center in really criticizing the Justice Department's strategy of prosecuting January 6th insurrectionists. I don't think he has any shame about this. I don't think he ever even considered recusing. And I think if he takes a pro-Trump stance in this case, he will be very vocal. He will attempt to lead the court in that direction. And he will not feel any sense of reticence just because his wife tried to overturn the election and was, of course, present for Trump's speech at the Ellipse on January 6th.
Just wow. And a real moment, a real crisis point for the credibility of this court as it decides some major cases this term. We will see what tomorrow holds. Mark Joseph Stern, great to talk to you. Thanks, my friend.
Thank you.
Coming up, as the right wing tries to oust him, House Speaker Mike Johnson today found time to visit Columbia University and demand someone else be fired, this time over pro-Palestinian protests. Coincidence there? Congresswoman Ilhan Omar joins me to discuss right after the break.
For protesting peacefully.
That was a scene in Austin earlier today after students at the University of Texas walked out of class to peacefully protest the ongoing war in Gaza. State and university police, some of whom were dressed in riot gear, descended onto the crowd, resulting in the violent clashes you see here. Dozens of student protests have taken place on college campuses across the country and around the world this past week. Protests sparked by the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza, where the death toll continues to rise amid reports of mass graves outside obliterated hospitals. At the center of all of this is an encampment-style protest currently on day 8 at Columbia University here in New York City. Today, Speaker Mike Johnson and some of his fellow Republicans traveled to Columbia's campus to speak out against allegations of anti-Semitism and to chastise the protesters.
My message to the students inside the encampment is go back to class and stop the nonsense. Stop wasting your parents' money, Congressman Lawler says. I think that's right.
And what about Zionist Jews inside the camp that are celebrating Shabbat?
I don't know who's in that camp over there, but I would tell you that this is unacceptable, and the American people are demanding accountability for it.
Joining me now is Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who has been outspoken about these protests and the reasons behind them. We're so happy to have her on the program. Thanks for joining me tonight, Congresswoman. First, let me just ask you, as a matter of sort of political strategy, do you see a connection between the fact that the far-right MAGA caucus is actively trying to oust Speaker Johnson, and today he went to Columbia to sort of maybe prove his far-right credentials?
No, I mean, it's very much of a coincidence. This is a man who is holding on to his speakership. He knows he might be on the chopping block. And it is not surprising that he would go out to Columbia University and stir up really more anger and hate and endanger the lives of young people who are at the encampment at Columbia University.
Do you have a theory? I mean, I have a theory, but the way in which the right wing has almost even taken it out of the like debate over free speech slash anti-Semitism and just made this a war against, quote unquote, liberal elites. I have to call out what appears to be, I don't know, staggering hypocrisy on the part of Josh Hawley, who's calling for the National Guard to be called in to disperse the Columbia protests. The same Josh Hawley who was fist pumping in solidarity with January 6th rioters outside of the Capitol. I mean, how do you explain the discrepancy between the way they saw those individuals and the way they see these individuals?
I mean, it's a complete clown show. These people do not care about violent protests. They don't care about First Amendment. They care about their performing their political theater, which is what, you know, they most of the time do. These are people who supported insurrectionists on January 6th, who threatened my life and the lives of all of our colleagues, who threatened the peaceful transfer of governance. It is really astonishing that they want to be taken seriously today as they call for the National Guard to come in. This is also a group of people who are first to criticize other countries as authoritarians when they call in the military to crack down on peaceful protests and people who are speaking up for their rights, people who are standing up for human rights, people who are speaking up against their government utilizing their own resources, their tax dollars, to help in what now has been considered a genocide that Israel is carrying out against the people of Gaza. I want people to actually understand why these kids are risking their academics and their ability to stay in good standing at their universities. They are worried what it means to grow up in a world where people can watch nearly 35,000 people be killed, to watch, you know, nearly 70% of them be children and women, to watch the destruction of 80% of infrastructure, to see a country withhold water, food, electricity, to starve people and carry out collective punishment. Israel's being hauled in front of the international courts and being accused of genocide. These kids don't want us to be complacent. They don't want their tax dollars to be complacent. And for the member who said, you know, like, don't waste your parents' money, they don't want their parents' money to go in supporting a genocide that they oppose. And so I do believe that history is going to be on their side, and these members who think this is a political opportunity to turn the world against these people who are standing for a morally just right cause are going to be looked at and mocked in history.
I know that you recently visited an encampment at the University of Minnesota. Your daughter was expelled from, arrested and suspended from Barnard last week for being involved in the protests in that campus. Senator Tom Emmer said that your speech at that encampment solidifies the Democrat Party as the pro-terrorist party. What is your response to an accusation like that?
I can't consume Emmer's failures. He's not going to use me to get in good standing with his conference. This is probably one of the worst whips to exist in the history of Congress. What I did was stand in solidarity with young people who are anti-war, who don't want their resources being utilized for war. What Emmer does is stand with insurrectionists and believes that it is okay for his conference to visit January 6th insurrectionist prisoners and call them political dissidents. This whole conference is a joke, and nobody should take them seriously.
In the meantime, we are seeing widespread protests, outcry for what is happening over in Gaza. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, thank you again for your time and thoughts on this. Really appreciate it.
As we should. Thank you for having me.
We will be right back. A quick programming note for you. In just 12 hours, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments on Donald Trump's claim that he is immune from all prosecution. MSNBC will be airing the full audio of those arguments starting live at 10 a.m. During those arguments, Trump himself will be sitting for the third day of testimony in his Manhattan hush money trial. So tomorrow night, it's a bonanza. We will have special coverage of both of those big Trump trials led by my colleague, the inimitable Rachel Maddow, starting at 8 p.m. Do not miss it. That is our show for tonight.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.